That's what she said.
That's what she said.
That's what she said.
That's what she said.
Well, that's what she said.
Hey, everybody. Welcome to the latest edition of That's What She Said with Sarah Spain. Excited to have Jessica Luther on the show today. I became Twitter and social media friends with her a couple years ago. She's at SCATX on Twitter. Never actually met her in person, I don't think, although I might have met her at this one ESPNW event in New York. Either way, I feel a connection to her over the interwebs for her excellent work. She's done some stuff with ESPN Outside the Lines, ESPN.com, ESPN the Magazine, and does a bunch of freelance work for other places. But she's just such a thought leader on connecting some of the social issues and sports that we talk about. She writes a lot about domestic violence and sexual assault, has a book about sexual assault on campus and sports. And she's just brave, super brave, and writes a lot despite really getting a lot of pushback and hate and obvious social media detractors who go out of their way to try to fight against her very well done reporting. And it's interesting to talk to her. I hope you guys find it interesting as well about the challenges of reporting on these particular topics and the struggle of, you know, having a healthy doubt and curiosity in what you're covering and also having the sort of compassion that's necessary to do stories with a victim and to really try to get down to what the truth is. So I hope you enjoyed the conversation that we had. I think it's important to have people like her out there pushing for the right kind of coverage. I know I personally, over the years, have learned a ton about both domestic violence and sexual assault just from trying to cover it and trying to give voice to a perspective on it that isn't the norm and perhaps isn't the natural way for it to be covered by most people in sports. I think the conversation has changed a lot over recent years, and I talk about that with Jessica about how much better it's gotten, but that doesn't mean there still isn't a lot of work to be done. Hope you enjoy our conversation.
That's what she said.
More That's What She Said coming up in just a second, but first, a plea to hear from you. I love doing this podcast, and I love getting the chance to talk to people that I find interesting. I want to hear what you love about it, too. Whether you're new or you've been listening for a while, let me know how I'm doing. Let me know guests that you want to hear from, who have been your favorites, people that you want to recommend. And if you're listening in Apple Podcasts, go ahead and leave me a rating and a review. Try to help spread the word so that people know that I'm over here doing this podcast. Doesn't get a ton of publicity. And it's really just a one-woman show, so I want to hear your thoughts, and I want you to spread the word if you like it. If you subscribe, that'll make it easier for you to find next time. And if you subscribe in the ESPN app, we'll send you an alert whenever we have a new episode, so that's great, too. You can also always tweet your thoughts at Sarah Spain.
That's what she said.
Happy to have on the pod today freelance journalist Jessica Luther. Her work has appeared in ESPN the Magazine, New York Times Magazine, Sports Illustrated, BuzzFeed, Vice Sports, and more. She's also the author of Unsportsmanlike Conduct, College Football and the Politics of Rape, and a co-host of the Burn It All Down podcast. Thanks for welcome in, Jessica. Thanks for making time for us.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
So I want to start at the very beginning. A lot of your work on sports is culture-based, and you do a lot on violence against women and the sort of social issues that intersect with sports. But I want to go way back to when you were just a kid growing up. What was the dream back then? What did you want to do?
Oh, gosh. I don't know. I do know. At some point when I was young, I wanted to be a marine biologist very mm-hmm. badly. I had this dream of, like, working with dolphins.
And me too. And then I took a science class in marine biology, and I was like, oh, I'm terrible at all of this. I could not do this.
Yeah, I don't remember when I sort of gave that up. But for a long time, and what was it? It was like 2001 Space Odyssey, maybe. He had, like, dolphins in his house. I just remember, like, watching that and being like, that would be the goal. But that feels like, I mean, a long time ago that I used to dream about that.
So where did you grow up? Where were you living?
Well, my dad was in the Air Force, so I moved around a lot. But by seventh grade, we ended up in Melbourne, Florida, which is on the East Coast, about halfway down. So it's part of the Space Coast. The house would shake when the space shuttles would take off or land.
Oh, my gosh. And there was never a childhood desire to be in NASA, be an astronaut.
I think so, but I mean, certainly, like, I'm sort of obsessed with space and astronauts. We actually, when I went to Florida State and I was an orientation leader one summer, and I want to say the VP of Student Affairs maybe was a former astronaut. And the first time I met him, I shook his hand and like an idiot, I just kept saying, "You've been in space. You've been in space." He was like, "Yes, I have. Yes, I, but I mean, I love the idea of it. It was never something I thought I could do. But I am one of those people who sort of dreams of going to space, and I'm obsessed with people who've done it. Like what a thing to have done in your life."
Yeah. Kind of unbelievable. Seems like a whole different, I was going to say universe. It's not a different universe technically, scientifically, but, okay. So you end up at Florida State University, and you mm-hmm. major in classical civilizations and Greek and Latin. What was the goal there?
Goodness, I don't know. And bless my parents' heart, because they were so patient. Like, my sister went on to be a fashion designer, and she's incredibly good at it and has been incredibly successful. But I can just imagine, like, what they were thinking about the two of us. They were clear from the jump that they're very supportive, but they're like, "You'll probably need to go on and get your PhD." So I think from the moment when I decided that's what I was going to do, the sort of end goal was to teach at the university level and do that kind of research with it. I was just so enamored with, I've always loved history, and I had this amazing Latin teacher in high school, and actually she just passed away a couple weeks ago, which is incredibly sad because she really set me on a path. Her love of the classical world, she really instilled in me. And so, yeah, I mean, that's what I was going to do at that time. For a long time, that's what I was going to do.
And that's where your love of sports really grew, right? Was it Florida State?
Well, my dad and my mom both went to Florida State. But my parents divorced when I was about 3, and my dad's been remarried for, I don't know, 25 years or so now. And my mom actually has been with the same person for like 30 years. So I grew up with my dad, though, and in those, you know, formative years as a child, there was one TV in the whole house, and my dad watched football. Like, he was a diehard, he still is, diehard Florida State football fan and also a Cowboys fan. Even though he grew up in Jacksonville, Florida, he was born in Texas and just always loved the Cowboys. And so I just, that was part of my upbringing, was watching football and my dad teaching me about football. And I only applied to go to one school. I was going to go to Florida State, and that was it. And a big part of that for me was that I wanted to go to football games, and I wanted to be in that sports culture as an undergrad. And I went to every home game. Like, one time I actually injured myself in college and I needed crutches just for a few days. And they were like, "You can't go to the football game this weekend." So of course I just like took my crutches with me.
Of course,
when I
yes.
went to the football game. And like, I was there in, for the 99 championship run. So in early 2000, I went to the Sugar Bowl when we beat Michael Vick's Virginia Tech Hokies to win the national championship. Like, that was a formative and important part of my undergrad, was being at Florida State and being a fan. And I also played basketball for a few years. I'm 6 feet tall, and so when you're in eighth grade, that's really helpful for playing basketball.
Don't I know?
But I wasn't good, so I didn't do that for very long, even though I loved it. But yeah, I would really say it sort of traces back to like that one TV in the house and just being immersed in it.
So then you leave Florida State and you go to Austin to do graduate school at the University of Texas. You get your master's in Latin literature. You're in the history department at UT, and you spend a couple mm-hmm. years there, realize that a PhD would be the next step, and decide at that point that pursuing further education isn't what you want anymore. What was the pivot point that you said, "Okay, this is it. It's time to make a move"?
You know what? It was really, really late. I actually spent a lot of time in graduate school at UT and in the history department. I actually started my dissertation. I had a fair amount of it written I just didn't want to be a professor anymore. I didn't like the politics of academia. I didn't want to leave Austin. And most of the time, wherever you get your PhD, you don't get to stay. So you're going to have to move somewhere. I had a kid when I was in grad school, and we were raising our kid here in Austin, and we wanted to be able to stay. And then I just was kind of over it. Like, it wasn't where I wanted to be. It wasn't what I wanted to be doing. And I had a friend say to me, I want to say in early 2013, she was an editor at Feministing at the time, which is a feminist blog. She's now a senior editor at HuffPo. But I remember her saying to me, like, you can get paid to write. And I was like, what? Because you don't get paid to write in the academy. That is not something, maybe now there's more discussion about it, but not at the time. And she really held my hand and, like, showed me how to pitch and where to pitch. And my first piece is, like, this really dumb thing about I read a lot of romance novels. And so I think I wrote about romance novels for Bitch Magazine's site. And that was, like, the first paid piece I did. And then the second, though, was a cold pitch to The Guardian about homophobia in the NFL. And they took it. I think it's so amazing to me. Like, they took the pitch, and then I wrote the piece, and it went up, and that was it. And I was like, oh, like, this is a thing I could
so
do.
Easy.
Like,
yeah.
I could do this. And so, but I was still in grad school at the time, so I didn't have, like, the pressure to do it a lot. Like, I didn't have to publish every day or something like that. Like, I had, you know, I was still pretending that I was going to get my PhD, and I was, you know, working at the university and that sort of thing. So it was sort of a slow progression from doing that original writing to actually, like, I left at the end of 2013. I finally left grad school. And it was at that point that I really started to write for real and for, like, my job.
So when you first kind of get out of that sort of safety blanket that is grad school and you're trying to be just a professional writer and freelancer, what drove you to decide what to pitch, and how did you decide? Was there anything about your time in academia that thought you had certain, like, knowledge that you could use, or did you use any of that in your pitches, or was it a total right turn in terms of, I'm going to do sports now or social issues in sports?
Yeah, it was pretty much a right turn. I mean, my dissertation was incredibly specific. I was writing on, like, slavery in Barbados in the 1600s under the English. And, like, but the thing that sort of connects everything that makes a lot of sense to me now is, I mean, this is true even back to my classics days when I left, you know, when I graduated from Florida State and went to UT. The reason I did that was there was a professor at the University of Texas, and she's still there, who wrote a book about women's bodies in classical Greek science. And I loved that book. And that, like, I was like, I want to work with this woman. I love this discussion about how we think about bodies and how that changes over time. And so then, you know, I was writing about slavery in Barbados in the 1600s, but I was really writing about, I was researching how becoming slave owners changed how the English thought about bodies in general, like, and about difference. And who got to own those ideas and those people and those bodies and how all those things work. So on some level, like, what I do now, it makes sense. I'm still here. Like, I write a lot about, you know, sexual violence and interpersonal violence and those ideas about women's bodies and ownership and difference and power. All those things are still in play. I've just now sort of married that to my love of sport and taken that critical lens into that arena. So it makes sense to me in the long term, sort of how all this is connected. But originally, no, I was just kind of writing about whatever I thought was interesting. It turns out that I was good at pitching. I don't necessarily feel like that anymore. But for a while, I just seemed to be able to play stuff. And I kind of accidentally got into this niche that I'm in now of, like, I'm the lady who wrote the book on college football and sexual assault. And that kind of happened by accident. But, you know, one of the things with investigative reporting, which is something I've been doing since 2014, like, all the history research that I did has really informed my ability to do investigative journalism. Like, I love documents. I just, not that long ago, I had to go out and buy a new filing cabinet because I had too many papers, because I love papers. I love having as much documentation as I can about stuff. That's certainly a historian holdover. The kind of questions that I ask, the way that I investigate things, comes from those same kinds of things that I learned as a historian when trying to figure out stuff. And then I think I'm a pretty good interviewer, in part because, like, I used to stand in front of a bunch of undergrads who hadn't read a book and then made them answer questions about it for half an hour. Like, you get used to sort of how, you know, coaxing stuff out of people. Those kind of things that I got from the academy are still with me.
So the Baylor story, it feels like maybe that was kind of where things took a turn for you in terms of notoriety, and you're becoming sort of the go-to person on stories of sexual assault on campus and sexual violence. Tell me how that, I mean, you guys essentially, you and your writing partner essentially broke that story 2 years before any of the mainstreams really started to dig in.
Yeah. So, yeah, I wrote it with Dan Solomon. He's a good friend of mine. He also lives here in Austin, and he writes a lot for Texas Monthly. So that's how we sort of ended up there. But, yeah, and we joke about before and after Baylor, kind of like what our lives are like. It was a big defining moment in both of our careers, and certainly for me because I concentrate so much on that area, that specific subject. And, yeah, it happened. I was already starting in late 2013, I started writing about this issue because in late 2013, the quarterback for my alma mater, Florida State, Jameis Winston, it came out that he had been under investigation for 11 months for sexual assault, and that the Tallahassee Police Department had kind of sat on it and not done much with it. And it's by the point when it broke, you know, there was chatter that he's going to win the Heisman. We were good again. Florida State football hadn't been good for a few years. It was terrible. And suddenly we're remarkable, and he's a huge reason for that. Like, we also got an offensive line that year, but behind that offensive line was this guy, just, you know, who was spectacular at playing football. And so when that story broke, I was paying attention because I cared about the school, but I was also just, I had written a piece for The Atlantic earlier in September, sort of talked about these things, and I was paying attention to it. So I started critiquing. I did the easy thing originally, which was critiquing the media.
Right.
Much easier.
Let me take down
this
other story note by note,
yeah.
Which is not.
Yeah.
It's still useful and it's still good, but you're right. It isn't as compelling or as difficult as creating a new dialogue.
Right. And a lot of that came out of my own surprise at how bad I found the coverage to be. Right.
Right.
Because I just hadn't been paying attention like most people, and. And so from there, I kept writing about it. And one of the things you find, and I'm sure you have found this too, is that when you write about these issues in any way that shows even like a little bit of compassion for the people who report, they start contacting you. Like, survivors and victims will contact you. And so by the end of 2014, I wrote my first basic investigative piece, around sexual assault on campus, and that had to do with the University of Tennessee at Chattanooga. And so somewhere, I remember August 5th, 2015, a source contacted me and said,
you remember the date?
Oh yeah. August 5th. And they contacted me and they said, I have this story for you about a Baylor football player. He's going to trial for sexual assault. No one's written about it. But I think maybe you'll care about it, and gave me the name, and we got off the phone, and I Googled him and couldn't find anything. And I thought, you know, part of your job as a reporter is to be skeptical. And I balanced that with, you know, trying to be compassionate to people who report, but it is your job to be skeptical. And I was just like, this is so weird that nothing is popping up. But the fact that they had said to me, this is going to trial, I was like, that's a really weird detail to make up, right? Or to get wrong.
Right.
If there's a telephone game going on here. And so I called Dan, because he's been a mentor for me. He's my friend, but he's also mentored me a lot in this transition I've made into being a journalist. I said, Dan, I can't find this guy's name associated with this at all. It's really weird. But I trust the source so much. So, like, you know, and he's better at Google than I am, which is something we found in our working relationship. So he Googled and found the trial docket. And I remember this so well. I called the clerk of the court, and I said, can I get the, like, can you copy that for me? Can you get that to me somehow, the documentation that you have? And they said, no, you have to come in person. Hmm. And I called Dan, and I said, I'm going. Like, Waco is about, I don't know, an hour and a half from Austin, and it closed at 5 that day. And I think Dan said, I'm going to go with you. And I think I picked him up at 1:30, and we got to Waco at 3, and we sat there for 2 hours reading the documents that were in the file. And we were driving back, and Dan was using his hotspot on his phone to email the editors of Texas Monthly, because we thought that we had a story. And so it was then 15 days between that day and the day that we published, which is like the fastest turnaround on something like that I've ever done. But Dan is remarkable. He's a fantastic writer. And then the editors of Texas Monthly were incredibly supportive. And yeah, we did not expect anything that happened. Like, we were not prepared at all for the response. We were like, hopefully someone reads this.
Why do you think no one else was in on this? How do you think they had kept it sort of out of the spotlight beyond the source that went to you?
I honestly don't know. So part of the timeline, like, one of the things I'm obsessed with are timelines, which is a historian holdover. So as we were driving back to Austin, the first piece published about that football player in the local paper when we were in the car.
Hmm.
And I know that I wasn't the first person tipped either. So I don't really know, though. I don't know if it was like they just didn't want to be curious.
Right. Or they didn't
about
want to put
it
the
in Waco.
Work in.
Yeah. Yeah. Like, but I don't really know. I mean, he has a name that is not like, it's not like John Smith, right? Like,
right,
his last name
is
Ukawachu in Waco. It's a hard question to answer, and I don't really have a definitive answer, but that was always a weird part of the story.
Yeah. And then it got bigger and bigger and bigger. Tell me about your book, Unsportsmanlike Conduct, College Football and Politics of Rape. So obviously there's a myriad stories about this, far more than we ever, I think, imagined. And it's more people speaking out. It's people like you who are writing stories about it that causes survivors to feel, you know, open about telling their stories and trying to connect with others to stop it. When you're writing this book, what hasn't been said, or what is your goal in writing it?
Yeah, that's a great question. One of the things that's funny about the book is that it came out in September of 2016. And so a lot of people thought that it was related to Baylor, because Baylor was a year earlier. And I had actually drafted it by the time we got to Baylor. I remember my editor called me while I was in Waco one day. He was like, I need the next draft. And I said, well, I'm chasing this story right now. I can remember having that conversation. So Baylor is actually just the epilogue of the book. So what I want, like what I hope people get when they read it, more than anything else, is I hope that they get that there are systemic issues here, that like, this isn't a Baylor, this isn't one player, this isn't one coach. Like, there are issues within the system of college football that are a problem, that encourage people to look away from this issue, to ignore it, sometimes to actively try to erase it once it gets reported. And those are the things that I want people to take away. The framing in the book is that it's a playbook, that when one of these cases breaks open, that certain entities respond in the same way every time. Coaches, university administrators, the NCAA, even the media, like there's certain ways that we end up all talking about it that makes it go away very quickly. And so there's not enough questioning of what's actually going on. And I wanted people to be able to take the book, so the next time a case breaks, I don't need to necessarily write this again. Like, if you've read the book, then you'll identify the ways that they're avoiding answering questions, so that we can start to, you know, so the media can question, so that alumni who care a lot, that want to change their programs when stuff comes out, so that even if it's not, if your program's not in the news, that you can, if you want to, call somebody up at the school and be like, are you doing these things to make this better on the campus that I love?
Educational.
I hope people pull from it.
It's educational, but also sort of a step-by-step as well, like a here's how things are going to go and here's how you should react and push back. I know you sent me the book, but I admittedly have not read a full book in 3 years, and that is very difficult for me to say because I love books so much, but I don't have time. Actually, I did read a book on my mini moon. I read Aziz Ansari's book, and that's the only book I've read in 3 years.
Nice. I only read romance novels, really. So
yeah,
I feel you.
I don't have time. It's so sad. But there are books that I have in a stack on my, and it's back because my husband wants me to clean up my bedside thing. But I'm like, if I put them somewhere else, it'll be even longer before I read them. They need to be in front of my face every night so I can be like, oh, start reading that.
Feel you. I have stacks of books everywhere. But the first two thirds of the book are the old playbook. The one we have right now is sort of how I say it. And so there's a chapter about what coaches and university administrators do. There's a chapter about what the NCAA does. There's a chapter about what the media does. And I would say the media chapter is actually the oldest now. Like, the media is getting better faster than anybody else. And then the last third, I used to know this, 13 chapters maybe of stuff that I would want to see changed if there was a new playbook. Like, this is how we'll talk about consent.
Right.
We will hire more women. Coaches will lose their jobs. I actually wrote that before anyone lost their jobs. So, and then Art Briles and Clays at Minnesota both lost their jobs. There's 13 different ideas of like things that could change, a new playbook that we could have if we really do want to fix this. So it's kind of both. It's like an assessment of where we are and things that I would change if I could, if I was in charge of the world.
Gosh, don't you wish that there were certain books that you could, like, force people to read? Like, the majority of our country would be forced. Because you know the people who are going to read this are all people who are invested in this being handled correctly and the problem being fixed. And the people who won't are the ones who most need to. It's so frustrating. You know, you mentioned about the patterns. And it is interesting to see how the media has changed in terms of coverage, but how then people get so used to the reporting that they become numb to it. And that's really difficult, too. The Baylor story, I know, eventually it got so detailed that by the end, people didn't want to hear about it anymore.
Yeah, there's an absolute fatigue. I have fatigue. I call it, like, ostrich. Like, I just stick my head in the sand.
Yeah.
You know, like, I was in the airport flying back from wherever when three Michigan State players were arrested. And I remember I was in the restaurant bar and I saw it on the television. I was like, oh man, like I'm going to get a call. And 2 days later, someone from the Detroit Free Press was like calling me on the phone to talk to me about it, which, you know, good. I will always do that. But I knew it was time to talk about it again.
Yeah.
And there was a part of me that was like, I don't want to read about this. I don't want to read this new case. And I absolutely have Baylor fatigue. I have kept up with all of it. And there are times where I'm just like, I can't take this in anymore. And you do, you get desensitized to it. But at the same time, I think I just get overwhelmed. Like, I don't know. I was just talking to a survivor the other day on the phone for the first time. And I think I see this every time that I talk to someone who wants to talk to me. They tell me their story and somewhere in it, I will say, man, I thought I couldn't be surprised anymore.
Yeah.
Like, you know, and I'm like, but here I am. You're telling me this thing, and I've never heard of this before at a school. Like, I can't believe this happened.
Right.
And so there's a part of me that...
It's hard. It's hard to get up and work on that every day and have it not affect other parts of your life. Would you say
that
if not for Jameis Winston and your connection to FSU, maybe your career wouldn't have ever taken this turn? Because you're not a victim yourself, are you?
I'm not, no. And so I don't know. I mean, I was certainly primed when this story broke. I had paid a lot of attention to the Vanderbilt case, which had broken. Four football players were arrested in, I want to say, June of 2013. And then that same summer, there were three Navy players on trial. And that was my first moment. That was also the summer of Johnny Manziel might have signed his autograph and gotten paid for it. And I remember sports media was really interested in Manziel and could have cared less about these seven players at two programs. And I ended up writing about that in September for The Atlantic as part of a larger piece about using women in recruitment.
Yeah.
Which became, you know, like that's one of the chapters in the book is a lot about using women as recruitment tools. But so it was definitely something that was on my radar and I had started to pay attention to and was writing about. But I don't know. I honestly don't know, because there is a real inertia to this writing. So, like, once you start writing and and you, people contact you. Like, survivors contact me all the time. And most of it is just to say, you know, either to tell me their story, to say thank you, you know, something like that. But, you know, a fair amount want to, they talk about wanting to go and tell their story publicly and do, you know, can I work, you know, will I work with them or, you know, and so that's just that it's hard to stop that. Like, I don't know when that will actually stop in my life. That's a really regular occurrence at this point. And you feel like I want to do this work for those people. And so you keep going, you know.
I think one of the things that's hardest about this is that so many people are willing to speak on it without having any knowledge. And also so many people are willing to take a very strong side with no facts. And I'm not sure what the motivation is for taking the side of somebody based on nothing. And the quickness with which usually it is men, actually always men, I've never actually come across a woman, I'm sure that they exist, but my experience is all men, who are rushing to defend the accused, and so often they have none of the facts. And they're not really interested in them either. It must be so frustrating, because I know it's frustrating when I write, to have people respond, and I'll be like, that, I very clearly wrote about that. I very clearly put those facts in there. Why do you feel so compelled to argue about something that you're not even willing to read one story about, a full story, get to the end before you come and try to light me up with how I'm wrong when the facts aren't important to you? That must be so infuriating for you on a regular basis to have people coming at you with zero facts and zero understanding of the larger issues at play, either in domestic violence or sexual assault.
Yeah, I mean, yes, it's really hard because there is just basic stuff that people don't want to engage with. Like, and I get, I mean, part of it is like, I do get it. So especially with sports cases, a lot of the time we're talking about an athlete or a coach or someone with a public face that a lot of these people think they know, right? They don't, but they think they do. This is true with reporters too, right? Like this is a full fleshed out human being to them that they hold up in some regard. On the other side is often an anonymous person that they don't know anything about. Literally the only thing that they know about this person is they've reported this athlete that they know. And it's easy to pick the side of the person you feel familiar with, right? And then for men, it's also easier to pick the side that they are, even though statistically it's more likely that a man will be a victim of sexual violence than a perpetrator. The way that our culture talks about this stuff, they assume that they have a better chance of being falsely accused, right? Like there's this obsession with like they could be the one who's falsely accused, which of course statistically that makes no sense, but that's how we talk about it. So they side with this person they feel familiar with their own fear of being falsely accused because of all of our cultural ideas about, you know, women that lie and all these sorts of things. And so I think I get it on some level. But at the same time, yes, it's so frustrating. Like, there's so much information out there about the actual statistics around this stuff, about false reporting, about how many people. Like, one of the things I say all the time when I talk about this is, like, you know a victim. If you don't know you know a victim, there's probably a reason that they don't want to tell you, right? But we all know victims in our lives and probably a lot closer to you than you imagine. And that's one of the things that, like, it'll just break my heart when people are going in so hard. And I just am like, someone in your life is hearing you and you're talking about them right now and you don't even know it.
Yeah. It's a really good angle to take for sure. The problem is some of them don't care. I don't care. Well, what if
that's
your
true.
Sister or your mother or your girlfriend was the one who was getting repeatedly beaten? Oh, well, she isn't, or, you know, whatever, you know, it's
right. I raised them differently.
Heartbreaking.
Or like whatever. Yeah.
The interesting
Absolutely.
That you mentioned that there's a whole article about using women as sort of props and trophies and recruiting tools, because it was remarkable to me how many people, when I was talking about Louisville and Patino in that case, and I said,
yes.
If people don't understand the very direct and not loose, but very direct line between using women as props and recruiting tools and the entitlement that leads to sexual assault on campus, particularly in big football programs, they're out of their minds. People are like, I wouldn't even think about that. Of course. And that's why it's so frustrating. I think, you know, I personally, in my particular role, want to use my voice and my job to speak about things that matter. And I'm full of, you know, jokes and stupid stuff. And, you know, I like that side of everything just as much as anybody else. But I also like to get serious about stuff. And it's difficult for me to balance between speaking truth to power and losing my audience. You don't necessarily have to do that quite as much because you are a much more focused in your role and in the content that you usually provide. But how do you balance when you want to point to something that everybody else thinks is not that big of a deal and say, but look, if we don't think that this is a big deal, it builds, you put all these things together, and that's what leads to a culture where we just don't value women in any way?
Yeah, I think it's super tricky, and I do not envy people like you that have to do a much more balanced version of this than I do. I think I have a pretty established reputation for how I my sort of righteousness on these issues. And so people, that's how they meet me, right? It's through that lens. I don't know. I think there is something, there's two ways, right? One is the personal story, right? So if you want to talk about recruitment, I can literally like list for you different stories based on like how I think this will impact someone. So you can talk about the woman at Colorado in the early 90s who was running down the hallway screaming about being sexually assaulted and how everyone looked away and there were a bunch of recruits in the room. Like you can do an individual story. One of the things I do, and this is the thing that I do all the time, and this is absolutely my training as a historian, is I like to collect a lot of examples all at once. And I want to say, I want to inundate you with the amount of these cases. And that's part of why the book was really useful to me as a tool. So most of the time I end up writing about a single program. And then the fans of that program get really mad at me for writing about their program. And then they shut down because they don't want to hear it because this is theirs, right? But the book allowed me to say, like in the chapter on recruitment, and it's just like boom, 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 like all the way down, all the way to like a couple years ago, Army got in trouble for using female cadets to recruit football players. Like talk about your tax dollars at work.
Right.
You know, and then of course Louisville broke and that's like its own whole thing. And so those are the two ways. Like I think we can tell the individual stories and there's a real power
in specifics and details,
like really explaining the violence that's happening here, but also just look at all of these examples at once, and it's much harder to say there's nothing here when you can say there's a pattern.
Right. Yeah. I mean, it's hard. And what's great is that you do have your, because of the breadth of your research, you have an example for everything. And so sometimes I get stuck, or I'll try to be making a point. It was interesting, actually. I left for my honeymoon the day after the presidential election. And my husband and I decided that for the 2 weeks we were just not going to discuss politics in any way because we wanted to enjoy ourselves and just didn't want to get wrapped up in everything that was going on back home. But the book I had happened to bring, second book, I've read two books. Okay. One was on my mini-moon and one was on my honeymoon. So I guess that tells you, as long as I'm not working and I'm in a foreign country, I might have time to read a book. The book I had already thrown in my bag because I so wanted to read it was Rebecca Solnit's Men Explain Things to Me. And it's a collection of essays, which I'm sure you've read. And I was thinking, do I really want to read this? I'm trying to like get away from some of these issues and I'm on my honeymoon. And it was such a quick read and I started. And instead of feeling hopeless, which I had been, and instead of feeling overwhelmed and lost about what this meant about the way that we view women and everything else, I came back and I was like, okay, I need to f-ing kick some ass. Like, I need to be even louder and more, you know, informed and more ready to take people on about this. Do you think that your particular work or the response to your work has changed at all over the last year or even half year?
Oh, sure. I mean, I think, well, for one, I'm tired. What I do have to, like, I have to be really invested in it in a new way. But I just think in general, we're having a different discussion about these things. You know, it's frustrating because on some level it feels like we're having the same one over and over again. But like we're talking about these issues. We're talking about them at Uber. We're talking about them at the presidential level. We're talking about them with entertainment, you know, Bill Cosby's trial. Like we had this amazing discussion around this with the I hate saying it like this, and I apologize. The Stanford swimmer case, Brock Turner, that's how most people know it is, the swimmer guy, with the victim impact statement that she released to BuzzFeed. We're having quite a conversation. And so on some level, people are always going to ask me about Duke lacrosse or the UVA Rolling Stone. Like, they always want to ask me about false accusations, and I have, you know, I talk about it. I have an answer for that. But at the same time, it does feel like I'm having a different conversation. Like, I'm having a conversation with a lot of people who know so much more than when I first started this. Like, when I write about Title IX now, which is, you know, the federal law under which universities have to investigate sexual assault allegations or sexual harassment or dating violence, there's a part of me that there's still an audience out there where they still think of it as a sports thing, Title IX, for sure. But there's so much more understanding, even if they don't get the nuance, like in Title IX, there's a lot of nuance there. But like, even if they don't get it, they understand that it's related to campus sexual assault in a way that they totally didn't get 3 years ago. So it's definitely changed. And I feel like we're having a better, more robust conversation. And I feel like media outlets are responding to it a lot better. Just today, I complained about a blog at the, I don't know, SB Nation's Cowboys site that was terrible about Ezekiel Elliott's case. And they took it down immediately and then put up a note saying they were sorry. I don't mean like I was the only one. There were a lot of people who were upset about it. But, you know, media outlets are responding differently. Like, people understand that they need to be careful in a way that they didn't maybe three or 4 years ago, too. So all those things are changing sort of the work that I do and how I do it and what audiences I'm able to reach.
Tell me quickly about the girls travel baseball story. What was interesting to me, first of all, I love the story because I had written about those girls before and I'd spoken and become friends with a couple of one of the families that you also spoke to who are just fantastic and they're so empowering to their daughter. But it was interesting when you tweeted about some of the responses the story was getting. And for all involved, the story is literally just about two teams of girls who play baseball. Not softball because they want to play baseball. That is all they are doing, playing baseball. And you tweeted out, I normally prep sources for backlash, but that's because normally I'm writing about sexual violence. I didn't think to prep this time. These are a couple dozen girls who want to play baseball. Amazing how threatening they can be. And it is remarkable that you would need to tell girls that you are writing about them playing baseball, just be careful that there might be backlash to this story. And the backlash was unbelievable.
Yeah, I mean, I actually have an entire protocol that I'll go through with victims of sexual violence or people who've reported before we publish about, you know, their safety online and all these sorts of things. I mean, I didn't mean all that stuff necessarily, but like, I didn't even do the don't read the comments prep, I did eventually say that at some point to the people who run Girls Travel Baseball, and I think even they were like, oh, that'll fuel us. But it ended up just being so much worse. And the vitriol was real. And we're talking like the girls I wrote about are from age 10 to 13. Like there were people who were mad that these girls dream of playing in the majors, which I just been like, let them dream, man. Like, even if you seriously don't believe they can make it.
Yeah.
But like, who cares?
Like,
just let these girls dream about it. And they're actually good ball players. So maybe they will, and they don't have to eat your words later. But it was so surprising to me. I will say, I do want to say that there was incredible positive response as well. So like a GM from an MLB team contacted me because he wanted to reach out to the girls. I know the Houston Astros gave one of the little girls tickets to the game tomorrow night. Or Wednesday night, I guess. They were on the phone with the National Baseball Hall of Fame at one point. So many people contacted them to tell them how much this meant to them, and they were so excited for the girls. And there are so many people who wrote me to say, can I donate money to this group to make it easier for them to afford the travel and everything. So there was an amazing positive response, and I really hope long-term that's what they take away from this. But it was the negative response was absolutely jarring, and just I was not ready for it. And I am someone who is often really prepared for negative backlash. So it is amazing. I just to reiterate myself, like, it is amazing that they can be that threatening, girls at the baseball.
10-year-old girls.
Yeah.
And then Burn It All Down. This is a new podcast. How did this come about?
Yeah, I'm co-hosting it with Shireen Ahmed, Brenda Elsie, Lindsay Gibbs, and Julie DeCaro. And we've just been friends for a long time, and we had, like, our little private message thing that we used to do all the time. And one day, I want to say it was Julie, maybe, that was like, we should just say all this in public. And so a lot of it is sort of, you know, critiquing sports culture and the media and stuff in sports. But also just like we love sports too, and we like to talk about it. So that's what we do every week. We normally have a few segments where we kind of, you know, talk about whatever's gone on that week. But then we have a burn pile. We all burn something from the week that we didn't like and we wish we never had to see again. So like this week, the nice one that comes out tomorrow, I was burning the Floyd Mayweather Conor McGregor press tour.
Good choice.
And, which I know that you wrote about. And and then we have a badass woman of the week. So we're always trying to like spotlight some women. And it's just fun. Like it's just fun to talk to a lot of ladies about sport. You know what that's like.
Yeah.
It's really fun. Especially in this male dominated field to just have the space to talk to some women about sports.
I completely agree. Where can people find Burn It All Down?
You can find it everywhere. So Apple Podcasts, iTunes, SoundCloud, TuneIn, Stitcher, Google Play, and online, our website, burnitalldownpod.com, has all the information.
Awesome. And what story are you working on now? What's next?
Oh, goodness. Well, I'm writing a book with Kavitha Davidson of ESPN.
That's right, my ESPNW teammate.
That's right. It's called How to Love Sports and They Don't Love You Back. And so every chapter is like a different issue in sport. And so it's Kavitha's. She's so good at titles. And so I'm currently drafting the chapter on doping in sports. And I just got off the phone with a Native American activist who's trying to end the use of Native people as mascots for another chapter. So I'm doing that.
So it's
that
not specific
right
to
now.
Women. It's issues
no,
in
no,
sports that are
sport
sort of
book.
Will turn anyone who's got a bit of a conscience and some decency, will turn them
off.
Yeah,
and if you're like that thing that bothers you about sport, like how did we get here with it and where is it going? Like we're trying to offer sort of the future with this issue. Where is doping going and should you care about it as a fan? Stuff like that.
Ooh, I'm excited for this book. This sounds awesome. I need some solutions to some of the things that worry me.
Yeah,
I'm ready. I'm here for this. Speaking of being here for this, before I let you go, you have to do the thing that everybody does.
Didn't expect a kind of Spanish Inquisition. Nobody expects the Spanish Inquisition.
That's right, the Spanish Inquisition. Nobody sees it coming. Number one, what's the natural talent you wish you were gifted with?
Oh, goodness. I wish that I could pick up languages. I'm horrible at other languages.
Oh, that's a good one. Number two, your Desert Island album.
Oh, goodness. Oh, man. I'm horrible at stuff like this. I want to say right now, today, I would pick Bleacher's first album.
Okay. All right. Number three, if you could switch lives with anyone for a day, who would it be?
Oh, anyone. I would probably want to play in the WNBA and be really good at it. So maybe like Diana Taurasi.
Oh, that would be awesome for one day.
Yeah, one day.
Just one day. And as basketball player myself, I would like to just have that kind of J. Four, what's the most scared you've ever been?
Oh, the most scared. Shoot. I don't know. Probably giving birth.
Just the once so far?
Yeah. Oh, that one and done.
Okay.
Yeah.
Number five, what habit or quality do you think has contributed most to your success?
Oh, I think my curiosity. I really, really like to learn. Sometimes it's a hindrance because I can't stop, but I will I just like to hear about everything. I take everything in.
Yeah, me too. My husband always thinks I'm being a know-it-all when we go on like tours and places. And I'm like, I'm just interested in anything. Like if we're on a bourbon tour,
exactly.
I'm going to ask a question about how the bourbon is made. If we're on a whatever, like I just constantly curious about whatever situation I'm in. I want to learn something. I think that's what makes a lot of good journalists. Number six, what's the thing about yourself you'd most like to improve?
Oh, my focus. I'm so it's really hard for me to maybe that's the curiosity, that's the flip side of the curiosity. But yeah, I wish that my husband is so focused. I just find it so incredible. Like, he can just sit down for like 3 hours and work on something nonstop. And like, he can't stop until it's over. And I'm always impressed by his ability to do that.
What is distracting you?
Oh, right now?
Like, when you're having loss of focus, what's distracting you?
Oh, I don't know. My brain just kind of wanders. Like, I'm currently not on Twitter very much, and that was part of my...
That's what I was going to say. When I have to write something, I have to close my other windows, because I'll see a notification. I'll be like, I wonder what's going on there. So I have to close all my other windows except for things I'm using to research. And I use this app called Coffitivity. Have you ever heard of that website?
No. I've heard of these where they, like, shut down your
access. No, it's actually really simple. It's just, it sounds like it's like noises of a coffee shop.
Oh,
so it's not music, which I start singing along to or listening to the melodies and the, you know, notes and everything. But it's also not, like, ambient noise. It just kind of sounds like the background of a coffee shop with some murmuring and some clinking cups. And, like, I always use that when I write because it just gives me this background. It might help. Number seven, what three words would you most hope people would use to describe you?
Oh, that's hard, Sarah.
I know. It's a deep one.
I hope that they would say that I was smart, that I was empathetic, and I think, I don't know, I want to say careful. I don't know. That's what I try to be.
That's good. I like those. I love that I never get the same three. Thank you so much for taking time. I could talk to you forever. We'll have to have you on again to talk about whatever's next coming down the pipe and about your book with Kavitha. I'll have to have you both on. That'll be fun. But thanks
for
making time. Really good stuff.
Thank you.
Oh, and another thing.
This week's edition of That's What She Read is actually a story that Jessica wrote. I mentioned it in the conversation that we had called A Team of Their Own. It's in Bleacher Report magazine, which is online, so you can find it at bleacherreport.com by searching Jessica Luther and A Team of Their Own. It's the story about the girls' travel baseball that I mentioned, and here's a little excerpt from it. The youngest of all the GTB girls is Savannah Strickland, who turned 10 in February. She lives in Tallahassee, Florida, and like all her teammates, she's the only girl on a local travel team. When asked how long she's played baseball, she thinks about it and then says, "For as long as I can remember." Strickland pauses and then asks, "Can I say something else?" Confidently and unprompted, she says, "I will want to play baseball until I'm not allowed to play anymore." She's only ever known baseball, and she already knows one day someone will stop her from playing. Good stuff from Jessica Luther. Check it out on bleacherreport.com. And as I mentioned earlier, you can follow her at SCATX on Twitter. Thanks, as always, for lasting about an hour with me.
That's what she said.